Chapter 13 Points of Decision 1 A mile of lonely beach separates Port Prodigal from the ruins of its fallen stone sentinel, Castana Voressa, Fort Glorious. Built to dominate the northern side of the bay serving Fort Glorious before a shift in the fortunes of the ghost winds brought an equivalent change to the city's name, the fort would not now suffice to ward off an attack with vulgar language, let alone the blades and arrows of a hostile force. To say that it was constructed cheaply would be an injustice to skinflint stonemasons. Several whole shiploads of Ferrari granite blocks were diverted into the home-building trade for wine money by bored officials far from home. Grand plans for walls and towers became grand plans for a wall, and finally modest plans for a smaller wall with barracks, and as a capstone to the entire affair, the garrison of soldiers intended for those barracks was lost in transit to a summer's end storm. The only useful remnant of the fort is a circular stone pavilion about 50 yards offshore, linked to the main ruins by a wide stone causeway. This was intended to be a platform for catapults, but none ever came. Nowadays, when the pirate captains of Port Prodigal call a council to discuss their affairs, this pavilion is always the place, and dusk is always the time. Here the captains do business in private, standing on the stones of a Ferrari empire that never was, atop the frustrated ambitions of a city-state that had nonetheless frustrated their own ambitions 7 years before. 2. It began as every such meeting Zamira could remember, under the purple-red sky of sunset, with lanterns set out atop the old stones, with the humid air thick as an animal's breath, and the biting insects out in force. There was no wine, no food, and no sitting when the Council of Captains was called. Sitting only made people more inclined to waste time. Discomfort stripped sentiment from everyone's words and brought them to the heart of their problems with haste. To Zamira's surprise, she and Ezri were the last to arrive. Zamira glanced around at her fellow captains, nodding cordially as she eyed them all in turn. First there was Rodanov, armed now, with his first mate, Idrena Koros, a trim blonde woman only slightly taller than Ezri. She had the poise of a professional duelist and a reputation with the wide-bladed Gereshti scimitar. Beside them stood Piero Strozzi, an amiable bald fellow pushing 50, waited on by his lieutenant, called Ear-Taker Jack, for what he liked to slice from the heads of his fallen foes. It was said that he tanned them and sewed them into elaborate necklaces, which he kept locked in his cabin. Rance was there, with Valtero at her shoulder as usual. The right side of Rance's jaw was several wince-inducing shades of black and green, but she was standing on her own 2 feet, and at least had the courtesy not to glare at Zamira when she thought Zamira was watching. Last but not least was Jacqueline Colvard, the so-called old woman of the ghost winds, still elegant in her mid-60s, if grey-haired and sun-scorched like old leather. Her current protégé, and therefore lover, was Maressa Vicente, whose fighting and sailing qualities were not yet generally known. The young woman certainly looked capable enough. Until one of them walked away, then, they were effectively sealed off here from the rest of the world. Parties from their crews, about 6 from each ship, mingled uneasily at the end of the causeway. No one else would be permitted to walk upon it until they finished. So, Zamira thought, how will we do this?
Zamira, said Rodanov, you're the one who called the council. Let's hear what's on your mind.
Straight to the action, then.
Not so much on my mind, Jafrim, as on all of our heads. I have evidence that the Archon of Tal Verar may have inconvenient plans for us once again.
Once again? Rodanov made fists of his huge hands. It was Bonaire who had the inconvenient plans, Zamira. We should have expected Stragos to do what any one of us would have done in his place.
I haven't forgotten so much as a day of that war, Jafrim. Zamira felt her hackles rise despite her determination to be patient. You know very well that I've come to call it a mistake.
The lost cause, snorted Rodanov. More like the dumb fucking idea. Would that you'd seen it for folly at the time.
Would that you'd done more than talk at the time, said Strozzi mildly. Talked and sailed away when the Archon's fleet darkened the horizon.
I never joined your damned armada, Piero. I offered to try and draw some of his ships off, and that much I did. Without my help, you'd have lost the weather gauge sooner and been flanked from the north. Chavon and I would be the only captain standing here.
Stand off, shouted Zamira. I called the council, and I have more to tell. I didn't bring us here to salt old wounds.
Speak on, said Strozzi.
A month ago, a brig left Talvara. Her captain stole her from the Sword Marina.
There was a general outburst of muttering and head-shaking at that. Zamira smiled before continuing.
For crew, he stole into Windward Rock and emptied a vault full of prisoners. His intention, and theirs, was to sail south and join us in Port Prodigal, to fly the red flag.
Who could steal one of the Archon's ships from a guarded harbor?
Rodanov spoke as if he only half believed the possibility.
I'd like to meet him.
You have, said Zamira. His name is Orin Ravel.
Valtero, previously silent behind Captain Rance, sputtered,
That fucking little...
Quiet, said Zamira. Lost your purse last night, didn't you? Ravel has fast hands. Fast hands, a quick mind, a talent for command, and a way with a blade. He earned his way onto my crew by killing 4 Jeremite Redeemers by himself.
Zamira felt vaguely amused to be talking Costa up with the same half-truths he'd worked so hard to disabuse her of.
Yet you said he had his own ship, said Rodanov.
Yes, the Red Messenger, sold off to the shipbreaker just this afternoon. Piero, you saw it off the Burning Reach a few days ago, didn't you?
Indeed.
There I was, going about my business, innocently scooping up prizes here and there on the Sea of Brass, said Zamira, when I happened upon Ravel's messenger. Interrupted his plans, to say the least. I poked holes in his story until I squeezed it all out of him, more or less.
What story is that?
Rance sounded as though she had a collection of small rocks in her mouth, but she made herself understood.
Think about it, Rance. Who is Ravel? One man. A thief, clearly. Trained to do many unusual things. But could one man sail a brig out of the gated harbours in the Sword Marina? Could one man break into Windward Rock, overcome every guard there, free an entire vault full of prisoners, and pack them off in his brig, conveniently stolen the very same night?
Said Rance.
Well, possibly.
He didn't do it alone.
Kolvard spoke for the first time, quietly, but her voice drew the eyes of everyone on the pavilion.
Stragos must have let him escape.
Precisely, said Zamira.
Stragos let him escape. Stragos gave him a crew of prisoners eager for any sort of freedom. Stragos gave him a ship, and he did all this knowing full well that Ravel would sail south, come down to join us in our trade.
He wanted an agent among us, said Strozzi,
uncharacteristically excited.
Yes, more than that.
Zamira gazed around the circle of pirates, ensuring that she had their undivided attention before she continued.
He has an agent among us, aboard my ship. Orin Ravel and his companion Jerome Valora are currently in the Archon's service.
Ezri whipped her head around to stare at Zamira, mouth open. Zamira squeezed her arm unobtrusively.
Kill them, said Kolvar. The situation is more complicated and more grave than that, said Zemira.
Grave indeed, for these two men you speak of. I find it best to make corpses of complications.
Had I discovered their deceit on my own, it would already be done. But Ravel is the one who confessed these things to me. He and Valora are, by his claim, entirely unwilling agents. Stragos gave them a latent poison, to which he alone supposedly holds the antidote. Another month will bring them due for their next dose.
Death would be a favor, then, mumbled Rance. That bastard will never let them be anything but puppets.
Rodanov waved for her to pipe down. What, to hear it from Ravel's lips, was their mission? To spy on us, I presume?
No, Jafrim.
Zemira put her hands behind her back and began to slowly pace the center of the pavilion.
Stragos wants us to do him the favor of flying the red flag in sight of Tal Vahrar again.
That makes no sense, said Strozzi.
It does when you consider the Archon's needs, said Colvard.
How? Rance and Strozzi spoke in unison.
I hear that things are brittle between the Archon and the Priori, said Colvard. If something were to come along and put a fright into the fine citizens of Tal Vahrar, their regard for the army and navy would rise.
Stragos needs a foe from outside Tal Vahrar, said Zemira. He needs it with all haste, and he needs to be assured that his forces can kick it around with a will.
She spread her arms wide toward her fellow captains and their mates. We might as well be painted like archery butts.
There's no profit, said Strozzi, in bringing a fight to us.
For those that take their profit in coin, you're right. But for Stragos, it means everything. He gambled a ship, a crew of prisoners, and his very reputation on Ravel's mission. You don't think he's serious? He made a laughingstock of himself by allowing a pirate to escape from his secure harbors, all so he could wait to redeem himself by crushing us later.
Zemira brought her fists together.
That was Ravel's task. Convince us, trick us, lie to us, bribe us. And if we couldn't be made to serve, his plan was to do it himself, in the messenger.
Then our course is obvious, said Rodanov. We don't give Stragos a damn thing. We don't dance around his noose. We keep 500 miles between ourselves and Tal Vahrar, as we have since the war. If need be, we play meek for a few months.
He reached over and gave Strozzi's paunch a hearty slap. We live off our fat.
If we do that much, said Idrena Koros. Begging your pardon, Captain. This evidence of yours, Captain Drakasha, the word of these two men seems thinner than...
Not just their word, said Zemira. Think, Koros. They had the Red Messenger. Its crew, the survivors of which are now my crew, did indeed come from Windward Rock. The Archon sent them, all right.
I concur, said Colvard, though I also agree with Jafrim that standing down from provocation is the wisest...
Would be the wisest, interrupted Zemira, if Stragos was doing this on a whim, but he's not, is he? He's in the fight of his life. His very position is at stake. He needs us.
She paced the center of the pavilion again, reminded of the arguments she'd put forth over the years in her pretend turns as a magistrate for initiation rituals. Were these theatrics any more convincing? She hoped to the gods they were.
If we tip Ravel and Valora over the side and ignore them, she said, or shy away from Tal Vahrar, Stragos will try something else, some other scheme to trick us into a fight, or to convince his people that we're bringing one. Only next time the gods may not see fit to allow the instruments of his design to fall into our hands. We'll be blind.
There's more hypothesis here, said Rodanov, than just about anything I ever heard at the collegiums.
The Red Messenger and the prisoners do indicate that Stragos took a gamble, said Colvard. That he took a gamble indicates that he can't move openly or with confidence. Knowing what we do of the situation in Talvara, I'd say this threat is real. If Stragos requires an enemy, we are the only suitor at this dance that fits his need. What else can he do? Pick a fight with Balinel, Camor, Lashane, Carthane? I hardly think so.
What would you have us do, Zamira? Rodanov folded his arms and scowled.
We possess the means to strike back at the Archon.
We can't fight the Varari navy, said Rodanov, nor can we storm the damned city, summon lightning from the sky, or ask the gods to politely dispose of Stragos for us. So by what means may we strike back? Wound his feelings with vicious letters?
Ravel and Valora are expected to report directly to him when they receive their antidote.
They have access to him, said Colvar. An assassination.
For which they suffer the blame, assuming they live, mused Strozzi.
Good for them, said Rodanov. And what, you wished our consent to take them back to Talvarar and let them loose? By all means, let fly. I'd be happy to lend them a pair of knives.
There is, from the perspective of Ravel and Valora, only one minor complication, that they would prefer to acquire a permanent antidote and then do away with Stragos.
Alas, said Rance, we so rarely realize our desires in life.
Tell them that we have an antidote, said Colvard. Convince them that we have the means to free them from their condition, then set them loose upon the Archon. Whether they survive the assassination or not will be of no consequence.
Ezri opened her mouth to disagree, and Zamira fixed her with the most withering glare in her long-practiced arsenal.
Marvelously devious, said Zamira, when she was certain that Ezri would mind herself. But too convenient. In their position, would you ever believe such a claim?
My skull is beginning to spin, said Strozzi. What the hell do you wish to do, Zamira?
I wish, she said, enunciating each word very carefully, for none of you to be alarmed if I should find it necessary to raise a bit of ruckus in the immediate vicinity of Talvera.
And thereby call down our destruction, shouted Rodanov. Do you want to see Port Prodigal sacked like Montier? Do you want to see us scattered halfway across the world and our unguarded trade routes filled with angry Varari warships?
If I do anything, said Zamira, discretion would be...
Impossible, growled Rodanov. This will finish the job Stragos began when he crushed the Free Armada. This will destroy our way of life.
Or preserve it. Zamira put her hands on her hips. If Stragos is determined to push us, he will push us, whether we would dance his tune or no. I have aboard my ship our means, our only means, of taking the fight to him. If Stragos is knocked aside, the Archonate falls with him. And if the Priori rule Talvera, we can loot this sea at our own merry pace until the day we die.
Why, said Strozzi, would you want to play along with the Archon's design, even with discretion?
Ravel and Valora aren't saints, said Zamira. They're not looking to throw their lives away for our benefit. They want to live, and to do that they need time. If Stragos believes they're hard at work on his behalf, he'll grant them the weeks or months necessary to find a solution. And in the meantime, he's likely to stay his other plans.
Those weeks and months may instead be time enough for him to rouse his city, said Rodanov.
You must trust me to be delicate, said Zamira. As brother and sister captains, that's what I'm asking in the end. No matter what you hear from Talvera, trust my judgment.
A significant request,
said Colvard. You ask no aid from any of us?
I can't think of anything that would be more counterproductive than for all of us to show up one morning off Tal Varrar, can you? The Archon would have his war in about 10 minutes. So leave this task to me, a risk to my ship alone.
A risk to us all, said Rodanov. You're asking us to put our fates and that of Port Prodigal in your hands, without any oversight.
How has it been otherwise these past 7 years?
She stared around the circle at each captain in turn.
Each of us has always been at the mercy of the others. Any one of us could have raided too far north, attacked a ship carrying someone's royal cousin, murdered too many sailors, or simply grown too greedy to ignore. We've been in peril all the way. I'm merely doing you the courtesy of pointing it out in advance for once.
And if you fail? Asked Rance.
If I fail, said Zemira, there'll be no penalty for you to levy. I'll already be dead.
Our oaths of non-interference, said Colvard. That's what you want, isn't it? A promise to keep our swords in their scabbards while you throw the most important rule of our association out your stern window.
In lieu of any better alternatives, said Zemira, yes, that's exactly what I'm asking for.
And if we say no? Rodanov spoke quietly. If we, 4 against 1, forbid this?
Then we come to a line that we all fear to cross, said Zemira, matching his stare.
I won't forbid it, said Rance. I'll vow to keep my hands off you, Zemira. If you sweat for my gain, so much the better. And if you die in the process, I'll mourn you not.
I'll give my oath as well, said Colvard. Zamira's right. Our collective safety at any given time depends on whichever one of us is the bloody craziest. If there's a chance to kick Maxilan off his pedestal, I pray for your success.
Obviously Zamira Drakasha votes with Zamira Drakasha, Zamira said, turning her gaze to Rodanov and Strozzi.
I don't like any of this, said Strozzi. But if things go to shit, no ship afloat on this sea can run like my Osprey.
He smiled and cracked his knuckles. What the hell? You wave your skirt at the Archon and see if he's up for a fondle. I won't be anywhere near it.
It seems, said Rodanov once all eyes had turned to him, that I have the opportunity to be unsociable.
He sighed and rubbed his forehead.
I don't think any of this is wise, but if I may take your promise of discretion to be as binding as my oath of non-interference, very well. Go spring this insane scheme.
Thank you, said Zemira, feeling a warm flush of relief from head to toe. Wasn't that easier than cutting one another to pieces?
This needs to stay between us, said Colvard. I don't ask for an oath, I expect it. Stragos may have other eyes and ears in Prodigal. If this gets out to anyone not standing here, the time we've spent at this meeting, not to mention Zamira's mission, will be an utter waste.
Right, said Strozzi. Silence. All gods as our witness.
All gods as our witness, the others echoed.
Will you leave immediately? Asked Colvard.
My crew needs a night ashore. I can't ask them back out without that much. I'll send them in halves, sell off the rest of my swag as fast as I can, clear the harbour in 2 or 3 days.
3 weeks to Tal Varrar, said Rodanov.
Right, said Zemira. No point in any of this if our lads drop dead en route. I intend to be hasty.
She stepped up to Rodanov, put one hand on his right cheek, and stood on her toes to kiss his other.
Jafrim, have I ever let you down?
Never since the war, said Rodanov. Ah, shit. Even that was a poor thing to say. Don't put me on the spot like this, Zamira. Just don't fuck this up.
Hey, said Colvard. How can I get some of that attention?
I'm feeling generous, but keep your hands to yourself if you prefer to keep them attached. She smiled, kissed Colvard in the middle of her wrinkled forehead, and gave the old woman a hug. Gingerly, because it took pains to accommodate all the swords and daggers the two of them were wearing. Always thus, thought Zamira, always thus in this life. 3. Utgar was the one waiting at the entry port to offer a hand when Zamira and Ezri went back up the side of the poison orchid. It was 10:30 the 10th hour of the evening.
Welcome back, Captain! How you be?
I've spent the day arguing with the shipbreaker and the council of captains, Zamira muttered. I require my children and I require a drink. Ezri?
Yes?
You, Ravel, Valora, my cabin immediately. Once in her cabin, Zamira threw her coat, sabers, elderglass vest and hat haphazardly onto her hammock. She settled onto her favorite chair with a groan and welcomed Paolo and Cosetta onto her lap. She lost herself in the familiar smell of their curly dark hair, and gazed with absolute satisfaction at their little fingers as she caught them in her own rough hands. Cosetta's, still so tiny and uncertain, Paolo's growing longer and more dexterous by the week. Gods, they were growing too fast, too fast. Their familiar chatter calmed her to the marrow. Apparently Paolo had spent the afternoon fighting monsters that lived in her sea-chest, while Cosetta now had plans to grow up to be king of the Seven Marrows. Zamira briefly considered explaining the difference between a king and a queen, and deemed it not worth the effort. Contradicting Cos would only lead to days of circular argument.
"Be king! Seven Marrows!" the little girl said, and Zamira nodded solemnly.
Remember your poor family when you come into your kingdom, darling. The door opened and Ezri appeared with Costa and Valora. Or should that be Deferra? Damn these layered aliases.
Lock the door, said Zamira. Paolo, fetch Mommy 4 glasses. Ezri, can you do the business on one of those bottles of Lashani Blue? They're right behind you.
Paolo, overawed at his responsibility, set 4 small tumblers out on the lacquered table atop the tea-chests. Costa and Deferra found seats on floor cushions, and Ezri made quick work of the waxed cork sealing the bottle. The smell of fresh lemons filled the cabin, and Ezri filled each tumbler to the brim with wine the colour of the ocean depths.
"Alas, I'm bereft of toasts," said Zamira. "Sometimes one merely needs a drink. Have at it."
Holding Kos with her left arm, Zamira downed her wine in one go, relishing the mingled tastes of spice and citrus, feeling the prickles of icy heat slide down her throat.
"Want?"
said Cosetta.
"This is a mommy drink, Kos, and you wouldn't like its taste."
"Want?"
"I said..."
"Oh, very well. Can't fear the fire if you don't scald your fingertips." She poured the merest dash of the blue wine into her tumbler and handed it carefully to Kos. The girl took it up with an expression of the utmost solemnity, tipped it back into her mouth, and then dropped it on the tabletop with a clatter.
"Like piss!"
she hollered, shaking her head.
"There are some drawbacks," said Zamira as she caught the tumbler before it went over the edge, "to raising children among sailors. But then I myself am no doubt making the largest contribution to her vocabulary."
"Piss!"
yelled Cosetta, giggling and immensely pleased with herself. Zamira shushed her.
"I have a toast," said Costa, smirking and raising his glass, "to clear perception. I have just now, after all these weeks, realized who the real captain of this vessel is."
Deferra chuckled and clinked tumblers with him.
Esri, however, left her wine untouched on the table before her and stared down at her hands. Zamira resolved to make this quick. Esri clearly needed to be alone with Jerome.
"It's like this, Ravel," said Zamira. "I didn't know I'd be arguing for your plan until I found myself doing so."
"So you're taking us
back to Tal Verar?"
"Yes." She poured herself another tumbler of wine and took a more conservative sip. "I've convinced the council not to panic if stories come down from the north concerning the mischief we're about to work."
"Thank you, Captain. I..."
"Don't thank me with words, Ravel." Zamira sipped her wine again and set the tumbler down. "Thank me by keeping your side of the bargain. Find a way to kill Maxilan Stragos."
"Yes."
"Let me make something else clear." Zamira carefully turned Cosetta in her arms so that the little girl was looking out across the table, straight at Costa. "Everyone aboard this ship will be risking their life to give you your chance at this scheme. Every single person."
I understand."
"If time passes and we can't find a solution for what Stragos has done to you, well, your access to him can't last forever. I'll do everything in my power to help you before it comes to that. But if there's no other alternative, if time runs out and the only way you can take him down is to sacrifice yourself, I won't expect to see you again. Do you understand?"
"If it comes to that," said Costa, "I'll drag him to the judgment of the gods with my bare hands. We'll go together."
"Gods," said Cosetta. "Bare hands!"
"Piss!"
shouted Costa, hoisting his tumbler toward Cosetta, who nearly came apart at the joints with the resulting fit of giggles.
"Thank you, Ravel, for this gift of a daughter who will now be up all night repeating that word."
"Sorry, Captain. So, when do we leave?"
"Half the crew goes ashore tonight, and the other half tomorrow. We'll be scraping them up in heaps the day after, those that want to stay with us. Hopefully we can be rid of our swag tomorrow. So, 2 days, 2 and a half maybe, then we'll see how the orchid flies."
"Thanks, Captain."
"And that's all," Zamira said. "My children are up too late, and I intend to claim the privilege of snoring as loudly as I wish once you're all out of my cabin."
Costa was the first to take the hint, draining his glass and leaping to his feet. Deferra followed, and was about to leave when Esri spoke in a quiet voice.
"Jerome, may I see you in my cabin? Just for a few minutes?"
"A few minutes?" Jerome grinned. "Esri, when did you become such a pessimist?"
"Now,"
she said, wiping the smile from his face. Chagrined, he helped her to her feet. A moment later, the door to her cabin clicked shut, leaving Zamira alone with her family in one of the quiet interludes that were so damnably rare. For a few brief moments every night, she could imagine that her ship was travelling neither to nor from danger, and she could imagine herself more mother than captain, alone with the ordinary concerns of her children.
"Mommy," said Paolo, without any warning, "I want to learn how to fight with a sword."
Zamira couldn't help herself. She stared at him for several seconds and then cracked up laughing. Ordinary? Gods, how could any child born to this life be anything resembling ordinary?
"Sword!"
hollered Cosetta, possible future king of the Seven Marrows.
"Sword! Sword!"
4.
Esri, I...
He saw the slap coming, but it never occurred to him for an instant to try to prevent the blow from landing. She put all of her muscle into it, which was saying something, and tears blurred Jean's vision.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Tell you?"
She was sobbing now, but her next punch landed on his right arm with undiminished force.
"Ow!"
he said.
"What? What?
Why didn't you tell me?"
It was almost a shout.
He spread his hands to catch her fists. A punch from her to the ribs or solar plexus, and he'd feel it for hours.
"Ezri, please! Tell you what?"
He knelt on the narrow floor of her compartment, kissing her fingertips while she tried to yank her hands back. At last he let her and knelt before her, arms lowered.
"Ezri, if you need to hit me, then by the gods, hit me! If that's what you need, I won't fight you for a second, not ever. Just tell me what you want."
She balled her fists, and Jean braced himself for another swing, but she sank to her knees and wrapped her arms around his neck. Her tears were hot on his cheeks.
"How could you not tell me?" she whispered.
"Anything you want to know, I'll tell you now, just..."
"The poison, Jean."
"Oh," he moaned, slumping sideways against the rear wall of the cabin. She slid with him.
"Oh, shit."
"You selfish bastard! How could you not..."
"Drakasha told the Council of Captains our story," Jean said numbly. "You were there to hear it."
"From her, not you! How could you do that to me?"
"Ezri, please, it's..."
"You are the only thing," she whispered through the iron grip of her embrace, "the only thing on this whole fucking ocean that's mine, Jean Tannen. I don't own this ship. Hell, I don't own this cabin. I don't have a buried fucking treasure. I have no family and no title, not anymore. And then I finally got to take something in return.
And it turns out I have one significant flaw."
"We can do something," she said. "We can find someone. Physicers, alchemists."
"Tried, Ezri. Alchemists and poisoners. We need the antidote from Stragos, or an actual sample of his poison from which to create one."
"And didn't I deserve to know? What if you'd..."
"Dropped dead in here one night? Ezri, what if a redeemer had put his sword through my skull, or the crew had just murdered me on the day we met?"
"That's not you," she said. "That's not how someone like you dies. I know, I just know."
"Ezri, you've seen every one of my scars. You know I'm not..."
"This is different," she said. "This is something you can't just fight."
"Ezri, I am fighting it. I have been fighting it every single day since the Archon put the fucking thing in me. Leocanto and I count the days, do you understand? I would lie awake at night the first few weeks, and I was sure I could feel it doing something in me."
He gulped and felt his own tears pouring down his face.
"Look, when I'm in here, it doesn't exist, understand? When I'm with you, I can't feel it. I don't care about it. This is... it's like a different world. How could I tell you? How could I ruin that?"
"I would kill him," she whispered. "Stragos. Gods, if he was here right now, I'd cut his fucking throat."
"I'd help, believe me."
She released her arms from around his neck and they knelt there in the semi-darkness, staring at each other.
"I love you, Jean," she whispered at last.
"I love you, Ezri."
Saying it was like allowing some sudden release of pressure behind his heart. It felt like breathing in at last after ages spent underwater.
"You're like no one else I've ever met."
"I can't let you die," she said.
"It's not you. You can't..."
"I can do what I damn well please," she said. "I can get you to Tal Varar. I can buy you time to get what you need from Stragos. I can help you kick his ass."
"Ezri," said Jean, "Drakasha's right. If I can't get what I need from him, taking Stragos down is more important..."
"Don't say it."
"I'll do it," he said. "It only makes sense. Gods, I don't want to, but if I have no choice, I'll trade myself for him."
"Damn you,"
she whispered, and faster than he could react, she leapt to her feet, seized him by the front of his tunic, and slammed him against the starboard bulkhead.
"You will not!
Not if we beat him, Jean Tannen. Not if we win. But I have no choice. Make a new choice, you son of a bitch!
She pinned him to the bulkhead with a kiss that was pure alchemy, and his hands found their way down her tunic, down to her breeches, where he unhitched her weapons belt with as much gratuitous fondling of the areas not covered by it as he could manage. She took the belt from his hands and flung it against one of the stiffened canvas walls, where it struck with a clattering racket and slid to the floor.
If there is no way, make a way, Jean Tannen. Losers don't fuck in this particular cabin.
He picked her up, making a seat for her from his crossed arms, and whirled her around so that her back was against the bulkhead and her feet were dangling. He kissed her breasts through her tunic, grinning at her reaction. He stopped to put his head against her chest, felt the rapid flutter of her heart beneath his left cheek.
I would have told you, he whispered, somehow.
Somehow indeed. Man, she said, what a mouse he is made by conversation.
Oh, it's not enough that I have to take this from you. Now I have Lucano chastising me.
Jean, she interrupted, pressing his head more firmly against her with a hug, stay with me.
What?
This is a good life, she whispered. You suit it. We suit it. After we deal with Stragos, stay with me.
I like it here, said Jean. Sometimes I think I could stay forever. But there are other places I could show you, other things we could do.
I'm not sure I'd adjust well to life on land.
Land has its pirates, same as the sea, he murmured between kisses. I'm one of them. You could...
Belay this. We don't have to decide anything now. Just think on what I said. I didn't bring you in here for negotiations.
What did you bring me here for?
Noise, she whispered, starting to pull his tunic off. Lots and lots of noise.
5. Just before the midnight change of watches, Gwillem emerged from his new quarters into the narrow corridor between the ship's four smaller cabins. Scowling, clad only in his breech-clout and a hastily thrown-on vest, he stepped across to the door of his old compartment. Bits of flannel rag were stuffed into his ears. He pounded on the door several times. When no answer was forthcoming, he knocked again and hollered,
Tregann, you bitch! I'll get you for this!
6. Are her preparations almost complete, then?
The two men met in the roofless ruins of a stone cottage, south of the city proper, so close to the edge of the eerie jungle that not even drunks and gazers would crawl out to it for shelter. It was near midnight, and a hard rain was falling, warm as spit.
Got all our junk sold just this afternoon. Been taking on water and ale like crazy. More than enough food already. Once we scrape up everyone that wants to get scraped up tomorrow, I'm sure we're gone.
Jafrim Rodanov nodded, and for the 100th time cast his gaze around the broken house and its shadows. Anyone close enough to listen through the noise of the rain would have to be close enough to spot, he reckoned.
Drakasha said disturbing things when she called the council. What she told you about her plans once she's back at sea?
Nothing, said the other man. Peculiar. Usually she gives us a good week to get our skulls busted and our purses sucked dry. She's got a fire under her ass, and it's a mystery to the rest of us.
Of course, said Rodanov. She wouldn't tell you anything until you were on your way. But she said nothing about the Archon? About Talvara?
No. So what do you think she's...
I know exactly what she's doing. I'm just not entirely convinced it's wise. Rodanov sighed. She might call down a heap of shit on everyone in the Ghost Winds.
So now you...
Yeah.
Rodanov passed a purse over, giving it a shake so the coins within could be heard.
Just like we discussed, Keep your eyes open. Note what you see. I'll want to hear about it after.
And the other thing?
Got it here, said Rodanov, hefting an oilcloth satchel with a heavy weight inside. You're sure you have a place where this cannot be found?
My sea chest. Privilege of rank, right? Got a false bottom.
Good enough. Rodanov passed the satchel over.
And if I have to use this thing?
Again, like we discussed, 3 times what I just paid you, waiting for you once it's done.
I want more than that, said the man. I want a place aboard the Sovereign.
Of course. Rodanov extended his hand, and the other man met his grip. They shook in the traditional Vardran fashion, clasping each other's forearms. You know I can always use a good man.
You're using him right now, eh? Just want to be sure I got a place to call home when all this is over. One way or another.
Utgard's grin was the faintest crescent of white against the shadows. 7. North by east on the Sea of Brass, with the wet southern wind on the starboard quarter, the poison orchid dashed across the waves like a racing mare at last given her head. It was the 3rd day of Orim. After a day lost laboriously navigating the twisting, rock-choked passage called the Trader's Gate, they had spent 2 more dodging reefs and islands, until the last jungle-crowned dome and the last volcanic smoke of the ghost winds had been sunk beneath the horizon. "This is the game," said Drakasha, addressing the group she'd assembled on the quarterdeck. Delmastro, Tregan, Gwilym, Utgar, Nazreen, Oskarl, and all the skilled mates, carpenters, sailmakers, and so forth. Mumchance listened from his place at the wheel, and Locke listened from the quarterdeck stairs, along with Jean and a half-dozen off-watch sailors. If they hadn't exactly been invited to hear the captain's little speech, neither had they been dissuaded. There was no point when news would travel across a ship faster than fire.
"We're bound for Tal Verar," said Drakasha. "We're going to allow our new friends Ravel and Valora to conduct a bit of sneaky business ashore."
"Bounty," said Mumchance.
"He's right," said Gwilym. "Begging your pardon, Captain, but if we haul up in sight of Tal Verar..."
"If the poison orchid drops anchor, aye, I'm worth a lot of money. But if we make some adjustments to my pretty ship here and there, alter the sail plan a bit, swap my stern lanterns for something plainer, and paint a false name in huge damn letters at the stern..."
"What shall we call her, Captain?" asked the carpenter.
"I'm partial to Chimera."
"That's cheeky," said Tregan. "But what's the gain for the rest of us in this sneaky business, Drakasha?"
"Nothing I care to discuss before the deed is done," said Drakasha. "But the gain for all of us will be substantial. You might say we're going out with the blessing of the whole Council of Captains."
"Then why aren't they out here lending a hand?" asked Nazreen.
"Because there's only one captain who's best at what she does." Drakasha gave an exaggerated curtsy. "Now, back to duties or to slacking, as you were. Spread the word to everyone."
Locke was slacking a few minutes later, alone with his thoughts at the larboard rail, when Jean took the spot beside him. The sea and sky alike were bronzing around the setting sun, and the warm ocean air was nonetheless refreshing after the sweaty atmosphere of the ghost winds.
"You feel anything strange?" asked Jean.
"What, about the... oh, you mean the poison? No, can't say that I feel any better or worse than I have for a while. But I'm sure I'll try to get a message to you if I start vomiting up newts or something. Assuming you could hear anyone knocking at that cabin door..."
"Oh, not you too. Ezri nearly tipped Gwilym over the taffrail."
"Well, let's be honest, people will notice the sort of racket that generally accompanies an attack upon the ship."
and now you're about to have a sudden accident. By Jeremite Redeemers mounted on cavalry steeds, where do you find the energy?
She makes it easy, said Jean.
Ah.
She asked me to stay, said Jean, looking down at his hands.
Aboard the ship, once all of this is over, assuming there's anything left of us?
Jean nodded. And by me, I'm sure she meant you as well.
Oh, of course she did, said Locke, not entirely curbing his reflexive tone of sarcasm. What did you say?
I asked her. I thought maybe she could come with us.
You love her, Locke nodded to himself before Jean could answer. You're not just marking time while we're out here. You've really fallen off the cliff, haven't you?
Yeah, Jean whispered.
She's good, said Locke. She's got wits and fire. She has a real taste for taking things away from people at sword point, which is an asset in my book. And at least her you can trust at your back in a fight.
I've always trusted you.
To be at your back in a fight, sure. But her you can trust not to embarrass everyone before it's over. You two won the day on the Kingfisher, not me. And I saw how she got kicked around. Most people would have hugged their hammocks for a few days after that. She's too damn stubborn to stop moving. You two really are a good match.
You make it sound like it's her or you.
Of course it doesn't have to be, but things will change.
Change, yes, and improve. This doesn't have to mean the end of anything.
Take her with us? Three against the world? Start up the whole thing again? Rebuild a gang? Haven't we had this conversation before?
Yes, and
I was doing my best impression of a drunken asshole at the time, I know. Locke put his left hand atop Jean's right. You're right. Things can change and improve. We've seen it happen to other people. Maybe it can happen to us for once. Soon as we finish the Sinspire game, we'll be richer than hell, and no longer welcome in Tal Varrar's polite society. She could come with us, or you could stay with her.
I don't know yet, said Jean. Neither of us knows. We've decided to deal with the question by ignoring it for the duration of the voyage.
Excellent idea.
But I want...
Listen, when the time comes, you make whatever choice you need to, and you don't think about me, understand? It is a fine match. Maybe you could do better.
Locke grinned to let Jean know that there was no actual need to knock his brains out of his skull. But I know for a solid fact that she couldn't. Ever. So saying, he squeezed Jean's hand. I'm happy for you. You've gone and stolen something back from this whole dead-end distraction Stragos has shoved us into. Hold it tight.
There seemed nothing else to say, so they stood listening to the cries of the circling gulls and watched the sun sink into the far horizon, bleeding its fire into the sea. Eventually, heavy footsteps sounded on the quarterdeck stairs behind them.
My boys, said Drakasha, appearing behind them and draping her arms across their shoulders. Just the pair I wanted to speak with. I'm removing you from afternoon watch duty with all the other Reds.
That's generous, said Locke.
No, it isn't. From now on, you're detached to the Carpenter's mercy for afternoons. Since we're slipping into Tal Varrar for your benefit, most of the alterations to the Orchid are going to be your responsibility. Painting, carving, rigging. You two will be rather busy.
Wow, said Locke. That sounds like an absolutely grand way to spend the voyage.
It wasn't.